Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. It's dangerous. It's risky. And people's lives are literally on the line. Their words can mean the difference between life and death. This is the job of the hostage negotiator. The negotiator's job is to defuse a crisis situation and calm the hostage taker down. He or she must quickly learn what words to use and, more importantly, which ones not to use. In a previous episode, we covered Tony Karitsis, a hostage taker whose 63-hour standoff with police was dramatized in the Wondery series American Hostage. Hostage negotiation is not something I specialized in during my time at the FBI. I wanted you to get an insider's point of view on how the CIRG, the FBI Critical Incident Response Group, and the CNU, the Crisis Negotiation Unit, actually work. So I called up my friend Mark Thundercloud. He is a retired FBI supervisory special agent from the Critical Incident Response Group at Quantico, Virginia. He was one of several supervisory special agents who responded to critical incidents in the United States and in foreign countries, such as hostage situations, barricaded individuals, and kidnapping cases. Mark and the Critical Negotiation Unit co-workers also manage the FBI Crisis Negotiator Program and the approximately 375 special agent negotiators throughout the country. He organized many instructional courses and trained thousands of FBI agents, domestic and foreign police officers, military, and other personnel throughout the United States and the world in hostage crisis negotiation and suicide prevention. During his long career, Mark responded to major incidents, including the Ruby Ridge standoff in Idaho, the Freeman incident in Montana, the Boston Marathon bombings, and the Standing Rock, North Dakota oil pipeline conflict. He was also deployed with the FBI hostage rescue team and assisted in negotiations of kidnapped Americans overseas. When Mark retired in 2011, he received the FBI Director's Meritorious Achievement Award for negotiations conducted during the piracy-related hijacking of the Maersk, Alabama commercial vessel near the coast of Somalia. So that being said, I think he's qualified to educate us about hostage negotiations. And I look forward to sharing my interview with him with you. From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed lots of murderers, including serial killers. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. It's difficult to get a satisfying answer without diving deep into their mindsets. So that's what we're doing. And I will give you my best analysis in this series of what made them do what they did. This episode is an interview with Mark Thundercloud. Mark, thanks for joining us. I'm always happy to talk to a retired FBI agent, but I'm really looking forward to chatting with you because your career was so specialized. But before we get into hostage negotiation, how long were you with the Bureau?
I was hired in 87 and I retired in 15. So it was over 27 years. And then I was a contractor for 2 years.
How did you get into the specialty of hostage negotiations?
Yeah, well, I first was assigned to the Seattle Division, but to the Spokane Resident Agency, the RA, in Eastern Washington. And there was only four of us there. And one of the agents there, Ed Burke, he was involved in negotiations. At the time, it was called the Critical Incident Negotiation Team, and which was only a handful of negotiators in the whole Bureau. So I was lucky enough to meet him and work with him, and he got me interested.
I'm always curious, and I'm sure you may recall, when you're a new agent, everybody wants to know what you did before you were in the Bureau. How did you get into the Bureau, and what was your background?
Well, actually, I was really interested in law enforcement. And in my teenage years, I wanted to be either an attorney or, you know, sorry for that, or an FBI agent. And I went to Marquette University and graduated from their criminal justice program with the intent of going on to law school. But I was so tired of school that I got out and I was hired by the Milwaukee Police Department. And this was back in 1981. And I spent 6 years with them and then decided I was kind of stagnating with the police department and just applied for the FBI and was hired in 1987.
Tell me about your first negotiation. What was the background? How did it go? Must have been exciting.
Yeah, well, the first one was actually in North Idaho. At the time, in the 80s, there was a lot of interesting groups operating out of North Idaho. A lot of white supremacy and things like that. And this happened to be a fugitive. And Ed was the primary negotiator. He did all the talking. I was kind of what we call a coach. But he did all the talking and was able to successfully get him to surrender. So,
what were the circumstances?
You know, he was holed up. He was a fugitive. He had an open warrant. And he was at his grandfather's house, if I can recall correctly, who had lived in North Idaho for most of his life, if not all of his life, the grandfather, I'm saying. And Ed had another home on one of the lakes up there, and he was very familiar with the area. So he created a really nice working bond with the grandfather, who was able to relay essentially what was being said to the fugitive who eventually surrendered. So it really opened my eyes how communication and getting to know another person can have a major influence on that person.
So the fugitive, he had a hostage?
No, it was not a hostage. I'm sorry, it was not a hostage. It was more of a barricaded situation where he's with the grandfather. We knew he was inside. The fugitive was not talking, but the grandfather was. And Ed was able to, again, build some really nice trust and rapport with the grandfather. And I'm almost positive that if he wasn't listening, the fugitive, I'm saying, if he wasn't listening, then he was getting the gist of the conversation with the grandfather. So he was able to use that relationship to allow the fugitive a safe way to surrender.
So, Mark, you have worked in crisis assignments in Haiti. Tell us a little bit about that.
I went to Haiti a lot. And a lot of the stuff we did was by phone on occasion, because the kidnappings in Haiti, they happened so quickly and they were over quickly. So a lot of times we're trying to coach families how to deal with the kidnappers by phone. We just couldn't get there. In almost all cases of hostages being taken, especially kidnapped hostages, they're usually for ransom and some type of money is paid and people are released. In a vast majority of cases, that happens. In this case, I advise the guy. I'll never forget this. And I was telling the truth. Most of these cases, the hostages are released without any incident. Sometimes they get a little injured, but that doesn't happen too often. And I told him that. I told him exactly that. Well, in this particular case, I think what happened was the person who was kidnapped knew the kidnappers. And she learned their identities. And so what happened to avoid any type of identification, you know, prosecution, arrest, whatever, they wound up killing her.
Oh my.
I felt really bad. It is nothing that I did that was wrong, but I think I gave the guy hope and they wound up killing her, which was It was just terrible. But
you made reference to a guy. Is that the kidnapper you're talking about or one of the victims?
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear on that. Basically, I was talking with the relative of the victim.
Okay.
Who was contacted by the kidnappers and was trying to negotiate, trying to get a release, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was giving him facts, trying to reassure him that most of the times they're released. However, in this case, what had happened, it was learned later that she found out who the identities of the kidnappers. So, you know, in their state, they didn't want to be identified, so they killed her.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know.
Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital. On sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. So, Mark, what is the one thing that you found hostage takers want the most?
Well, what most people don't understand is there's a couple of reasons why hostages are taken, okay? And this is something that we teach our new negotiators. Hostage takers are driven by a couple of things, and one is emotion. When a hostage is taken during an emotional event, they usually know their victim. Could be a husband holding his wife and children inside a house. Mm-hmm. You know, the wife is now filed for divorce, going to take the kids. Well, he feels at a loss. He doesn't know the future. He's going through these very intense emotions. And so he decides to hold them, maybe threatening to harm or kill them, which, as you know, happens all the time. We read about it all the time. And so those are very high charged events and they're highly emotional. Mm-hmm. The people have these things that build up inside them. That's on one side. That's one spectrum. We call that the expressive spectrum of hostage taking. Mm-hmm. The instrumental spectrum would be the pure kidnapping for ransom. Okay, now I'm a criminal. I've got a couple friends. I've got this information that the niece of Bill Gates is going to be here or something like that, you know, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. I get my cohorts together. Hey, let's kidnap her. Let's try to extort Bill Gates. You know, he's got a lot of money, right? So that's the instrumental spectrum. I'm taking this woman or man or whoever it is for a specific reason, and that's for money. You know, I have nothing against the person. I just want to use that person as a tool to get money. Whereas the expressive spectrum side is purely emotional. Those are much more difficult to contend with because now you're dealing with history. Now you're dealing with the people that know each other and typically, at least at the moment, are having a negative relationship. Because why would that person be holding that person now as a hostage? Mm-hmm. So most incidents that we see when you hear of a hostage situation in the U.S., they are expressive. It's the man holding his boss. It's the man, generally speaking, usually a guy holding someone that he's having a negative relationship with at the moment. So that's how we differentiate. And you know what? The kidnappers are generally much easier to deal with, much easier, because they it's like a transaction. It's like a business transaction, literally. But how we help in a kidnapping, in most of my cases, were kidnappings of American citizens in different countries. What we bring to the table as negotiators, not the actual negotiation, because that's simple. That is easy. What we bring to the table is a crisis intervention, helping families contend with the crisis at their end. One of your relatives now is taken. It's going to be completely foreign. Maybe not you, Candace. You're aware of law enforcement tactics, law enforcement, whatever. Mm-hmm. But Julie, maybe she doesn't know anything about any of this. And now her husband, her relative, whoever it might be, is taken. And now she's got to deal with this. Now they're calling her. Well, Julie's going to be in, she's going to be in a pickle. She's going to, you know, she's going to go through a lot of emotions. What we do in those cases is provide some type of structure and hopefully a calming and reassuring influence.
How do you deal with somebody that is off the charts emotional, such as Tony Karitsis in the podcast American Hostage? I mean, he was, whoa, how would you deal with somebody like that? And of course, he's got that sawed-off shotgun at the back of his victim's head.
Yeah, that's a very interesting case. And what's really, what kind of shocked me a little bit is I've seen photos from that incident, but we looked at a lot of cases. We went back in time. I had never really looked at that case. So kind of refreshing to look at it. There's a lot of things, even if that would happen now, I don't, that's a really hard case.
Yeah. That's my next question. If this were to happen now with your decades of experience, you've got a hothead, unstable hostage taker who has a shotgun, a weapon that could kill the victim just in a split second.
Well, what we would try to do, and this is what we teach, we want to talk to that person ASAP. We want to get someone who knows what they're doing, if possible, or someone who's not going to create more crisis. And a lot of times, anytime police show up, and this is the first hurdle that law enforcement have to deal with, in most cases anyway, not necessarily this one, and we'll get into that in a minute, but in most cases, once the police show up, that's another hurdle that adds to the crisis. You know, your argument with the couple that escalates into some type of hostage situation. And when the cops show up, that just adds to the burden and pressure of the subject. When I talk about subject, I'm talking about the hostage taker.
Sure.
So that just adds to the pressure. In this case, and I was ticking off some of the high-risk indicators for this one. One is it's an expressive event. He knows and targeted the hostage. That's always a higher risk because we read about it. We see it all the time that the ex-worker goes back to the workplace and typically he starts killing people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this case, he took him hostage, had the shotgun. And so that was high risk. The other thing that creates caution for us is the fact that he contacted the police. I'm calling the police. Now, I want them to be here. So we always question why that. If he wants police there, either murder or suicide, you know, he wants confrontation. So that was a negative as far as an indicator for me in this particular case. But what we would try to do initially is just listen to the guy. We'd get someone who can allow that person to talk and vent, and believe me, he was, and not create any more pressure, not be confrontational. Tony, as you guys know, you listen to all that. He was ready for a confrontation. If you had someone challenging him, it probably would have went sideways, or, you know, it would have went very badly. So I think what they did was probably okay. And we would also try to limit his mobility if possible. In this case, it would have been hard.
Tony not only was emoting, to say the least. He was moving with his target from here to there.
Right.
Slips on the ice, gets in a cop car. This particular hostage taking was 45 years ago. And I was unaware of it until I listened to the podcast. And then I did some more research and found a fabulous documentary. The documentary was made by two men who were 7 years old when this case happened in 1977. And here they are many years later doing a documentary on the subject. If you had to negotiate the Tony situation, what kind of things would you be looking for? You've mentioned, well, you couldn't not see that Tony was over the top, angry, and unstable. What would you do in a situation like that?
Well, what we train our folks to do, again, is to immediately begin conversation. All right.
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, if it were me, I would get on the phone or talk to him in some regard and be there from the earliest as possible. And I would have someone with me as a coach, we call them, or second.
Mm-hmm.
And we would work together. And initially, in most of these cases, especially if they're expressive events, they have a lot of things to say. As you heard, Tony had a lot of things to say for 3 days, it seemed like. But we would just listen to
him. Mm-hmm.
Again, I think that the things that the law enforcement did that were good was that they didn't completely confront Tony, because that would have been, I think that would have been very bad if they would have called his bluff or
mm-hmm.
some will say, well, they acquiesced too far. But you know what? For one thing, they didn't have the training that we do now. There could have been some type of tactical, maybe intervention, possibly, but that is very high risk as well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe with technology they have now, but it still would have been very high risk. So I think the best thing that we could have done and we would do is simply let the guy talk. You know, time is usually an ally in these cases, unless there's injuries involved where people are, you know, bleeding or something. Time is generally a good thing for law enforcement because there's so much pent-up emotion in Tony, and you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And he held that emotion for days, but eventually he's going to tire out. I don't care who you are. Unless you're on drugs, some type of stimulant, you are eventually going to tire.
Mm-hmm.
So we use that to our advantage. Although Tony, you know, he had a lot of stamina. He seemed like a very strong and had a lot of energy.
And his hatred for, or his belief that he had been wronged by the Hall Mortgage Company had been festering. He said since he signed the mortgage papers 4.5 years before he took Hall hostage. And he said, I've been waiting for this moment since the day I signed. So for me, coming to that realization, this was really a long-standing grudge that he had. And it also was misperceived. There was no evidence that the Halls cheated him. In fact, there was documentation and evidence that they'd been very kind to him. But Tony, it was almost like he wanted this big event. And then he calls in the media, demands, what, a TV interview? What would you have done today if somebody wants the press there? What would you do?
Well, that needs to be assessed, obviously, by a lot of entities. We talk about individuals here, Candace, what I would do. And I'm not doing anything
mm-hmm.
without authority. But yeah, we use media routinely now. I mean, mm-hmm. because it's there. We have to use it. If we don't use media, they're going to do what they want to do. So what we try to do is get ahead of the curve, and we'll make media contacts to prepare for some of these events. And we've used media successfully in a lot of cases. I don't know if you remember the little boy who was taken down in Alabama. He was taken into a bunker. This was like maybe...
Oh, the school bus driver?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, I wasn't on the scene. I was at headquarters for that event at SIOC, which is our command post. But I know that we use media really well in that case. We want to send messages, positive messages through the media, because we know, especially in today, it was happening, what, 45 years ago in this case. Today, everybody's got access to the media and their phones, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
So we use the media positive, or try to use it positively all the time. And even in this case, you saw what happened in this case when Tony was hearing some of the negative things. That hurt a couple things. It hurt the credibility of the journalist.
Mm-hmm.
So you heard that. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
So now his radio station is commenting on not only his past, but also what type of tactical event that might take place. Well, Tony hears that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then he calls up Fred, and he ruined, at least momentarily, that bit of credibility and trust that Fred was building with the guy. So
yes.
I don't know if you recall that. So, but one of the...
I do.
And again, this goes kind of goes back to a basic tenet of ours is we want to get on the phone with that person as quickly as possible. I want to be, if I'm the negotiator, I want to talk to him or listen to him for 12 hours. And then we have a rule that we're on for 12 hours and off for 12 hours. That's fine. That's why my second is there. Now I introduce, okay, now Julie's a negotiator with me, right? I introduce, well, this is Julie. She's going to be here with me. And on occasion, if I have to step away, you're going to talk to her. So everything is transparent. Tony, we want to build trust. We want to be credible with him. We don't want him to think that we're trying to double cross him, that we're trying to do something behind his back. In this case, especially because he was hypersensitive, he was looking for reasons to call the cops out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you talk about the media, that's why it's so important. We have to work with them, or else they're going to be a detriment, more than likely.
The press really catered to his side of the story. So much so, I think, that a portion of the public was actually rooting for Tony. Do you think the press and negotiators did the right thing by only airing what Tony wanted them to?
Well, yeah, I do. Simply because I do think that was necessary. Because ultimately, we want to get to why this is all occurring. We want to know the reason, okay? And usually it's a loss. Usually it's some type of loss. And in what's the loss here? Well, Tony lost his livelihood. He lost his respect. He lost money. He lost time. And the more we get that person to talk about it, the more stress is relieved. Okay. So, yeah, I don't think he needed to be challenged with other questions. Hey, look, but what about Mr. Hall's side of the story? Well, he doesn't want to hear that.
True.
You know, again, and you know why? It's because and it happens to all of us. When we are in a state of intense emotion, logic and reason does not apply. It just doesn't. You take anybody who's in a fit of rage or is angry, you can't reason or be rational with the person. So again, what we're trying to do with a guy like Tony is to get that person down to a more rational state. And how we do that is through letting him vent over and over again. This is not a one time you say this and he's going to be, you know, he's going to surrender. It doesn't work that way. It's like chipping at a boulder. We're trying to get this boulder down into small pieces, and it's one chip at a time.
As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500.
Mark, what are the things you look for when interacting with the hostage taker? Can you explain the differences to our listeners between hostage negotiators and profilers? And talk about if you've ever used profilers in hostage situations.
All right. What we try to do is we have to look at the behavior. We don't have the luxury of time. What profilers do, I'm not taking anything away from them at all. Sometimes they have a lot more time to look at things and analyze, and we don't. So what we focus is on behavior. What is he doing now? how he's talking. And the other thing we really look at is his history, because past behavior generally is a pretty good indicator of future behavior. So we'll look at his history or her history, whoever it might be, and to determine what happened in this person's past. I mean, has he been in a system a long time? Has he been to prison? Has, you know, a lot of these things will help us when it comes to talking with this guy. If the guy's been in jail a lot and he's been around cops a lot, then we might be more realistic with the person. Well, you know better. You've been in jail. You know how things work. You know, that type of thing. So we'll look at the past history. We'll find that out as soon as we can through criminal checks, things like that. And then we'll focus on behavior. What has he done? What is he doing? What are his statements right now? That type of thing. Do we incorporate profilers? Yes. If we can, we will seek the input of anybody. Because why not, right? It's always to our benefit to incorporate different thoughts and ideas.
Did you have to take any psychology courses at the Bureau that were specifically crafted to hostage negotiation?
We are trained in communication. We are trained to, because the day after you're going through our course, you are then a negotiator. So the next day, and we've had this happen to our students, the next day they'll go out and they'll be called on something, you know? And what we train them to be able to talk to someone who's in a crisis. That's what we train for. And again, most hostage situations in the U.S. that law enforcement involved in, they're not instrumental. Meaning, again, we're not dealing with kidnappers. We're dealing with people who are in a crisis, usually involving a relationship. So the emotions are going to be intense. So we train the people, our folks, to deal with a person like that. They have to be able to talk with them on the phone, by text, in person. And we train electronically now. We train because we have to. A lot of these things, they go electronic. They go by text sometimes. If they want to go off and get more training regarding psychology, that's fine. No problem.
Mark, how is the negotiator that actually goes to the site? How are they chosen? How does that work?
Well, it's not a whole deep thought that goes into this, but in most cases, it's the person that's available.
Mm.
In a case like Tony, would be the one that is on call. For our kidnappings, when we deployed overseas, it was a person that was available. And we had on-call rosters and all these other things. So really, it's like a rotor that we use.
Mm-hmm. And most field divisions, they don't have but a handful. I know I was in the Chicago division for 15 years, followed by the San Francisco division. And in both offices, it was just less than 5 people were trained, sometimes even less than, 2 or 3 in the entire division.
Yeah, you're right, Candace. Now that's been upped, all divisions have at least 5. And then the enhanced divisions, the larger offices, your San Francisco's, Los Angeles's, Chicago's, Atlanta, Phoenix, I think is an enhanced now,
mm-hmm.
New York, they'll have at least 8 negotiators. But a lot of times they'll have more. And some offices, the smaller offices have less. Like, for example, Anchorage, it's a small office. They don't have the personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Other things might be an evidence response, or they might be in SWAT, they might be have these other collateral duties. So sometimes it's hard, but all of the offices are mandated to have 5, and then the enhanced are mandated to have 8.
Do you think gender of the negotiator matters? You mentioned that most hostage takers are men. Do you know how they would respond to a female negotiator? Or how does that all work?
Yeah, we get this question a lot. We should plan on a certain gender, a certain ethnicity, a certain somebody for an event. But again, in real life, if an event happens, whoever's available is going to be going to be there first. And there are times when we've had subjects try to, well, I don't want to talk to you, I want to talk to him. That basically what we call it, they're negotiator shopping. They're shopping for someone else. But the problem is with that is that it never ends. So what we try to do is, now I'm talking to Julie. Julie doesn't want to talk to me. Well, I don't want to talk to you because you're a man. So it sounds like you have issues with men right now. There is something, did we just go with that? Yeah, I don't want to talk with you. Well, the problem is, what if I'm the only one here that could talk to you right now?
Mm-hmm.
We try to kind of string it along and try to delay, unless it really hampers and harms the negotiation, more than likely, any initial pushback is going to be absorbed, meaning they're just going to go with it. Short answer is, we don't typically do that.
I know some of the listeners might be wondering, what should they do? What advice would you give people in the event they are taken hostage?
We used to do hostage survival. And one of the things that we did consulting with military and things like that, because they had their training. So one of the things that I thought worked was a very easy thing to remember. If you can't fight or can't flee, then you float, meaning you go with the flow. If you can't get away right away, if you can't fight them off and escape, then you kind of have to float, meaning be neutral, be gray. I've seen where if hostages are over emotional or defiant, not good things happen to them. So there's a balance, there's a tightrope you have to walk. And that's not being too much of a pain in the butt to the hostage taker, but not acquiesce all the time either. So there's that. If you acquiesce too much, then you're losing your respect. And a lot of these hostage takers will recognize that and bully you or do worse. So it's really walking that tightrope and how to behave. But a guy like Dick Hall, what's he going to do? He can't really do anything. He's not, you're not going to be arguing with Tony. It would be futile. And even from the videos that we saw with Hall, he's not saying anything. And Tony's berating him, yelling at him, looking at him. His looks were pretty evil, I thought.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Hall wasn't doing anything. We're just standing. So the last thing would have been very negative for him, I think, if he was to start arguing or tried to, obviously, if he tried to escape, been really bad. So,
Mark, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed listening to it.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And, you know, maybe a few people learned something that they didn't know. Thanks a lot.
And by the way, you've got the coolest name ever.
Yeah, I thank my dad for that every day.
Take care.
Thank you, Candace.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Mark Thundercloud. If you'd like to know more about the hostage incident with Tony Caritsas, listen to episode 44 of Killer Psyche. Next week on Killer Psyche, part 2 of What We've Learned So Far, season 1. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Edited by Joshua Morales and Maxwell Carney, with research and editing assistance from Ann Liu. Our senior audio producer is Tom Monahan. Renee Levesque is production manager. And Haley Mandelberg is production coordinator. Brandon Clark and Lindsay Whistler are production assistants. And the line producer is Oscar Guida. Our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort and Marsha Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.